ஓம் நம சிவாய. டியர் லிசனர்ஸ் ஆஃப் சைவம் .org, தி நெக்ஸ்ட் ப்ரோக்ராம் இஸ் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் டிஸ்கோர்ஸ். இன் திஸ் யூ ஆர் அபவுட் டு லிசன் கவாய் ஹிந்து லெக்சர்ஸ். தி டைட்டில்ஸ் ஆர் அப்ரிசியேஷன், ஃபிக்ஸிங் ப்ராப்ளம்ஸ், டீப்பர் பெர்ஸ்பெக்டிவ்ஸ் அண்ட் ரியலைசேஷன். பிரசன்டட் பை ஸ்ரீ சிவாய போதிநாத வேலாயுத சுவாமி. தேங்க் யூ. ஓம் நம சிவாய.
So I thought I'd talk this morning a little bit about appreciation. We've been getting some copies of emails coming from members abroad, going to the members of the Wailua Mission, verbalizing their appreciation for all the hospitality they received during their stay here for 1 or 2 weeks or more during our recent event. And it's wonderful to see that, because appreciation is something we often feel but don't often enough express. Somehow it's just not that common, not in our social norm to spend a lot of time verbalizing our appreciation for what others have done for us. So quite often other people really don't know and feel the benefit of what we feel on the inside toward them. We haven't told them, so they don't get that. But it's important. It's in a very important part of life. And I have a story to tell about a bird. This is a true story. We eat lunch in the courtyard, seated on the ground, and we used to serve right out on the top of the counter, so we'd have all the serving dishes there. And one spring season, there was a bird. I imagine the bird had young. So the bird would come. It figured out when the food was out. So the bird would come every day at the same time, fly down, grab a little food, go away, come back a second time, grab a little food, and fly away. So we began noticing that this was happening every day. So we started putting out different little piles of food, so it was easier, so the bird didn't have to go into our serving dish. And so we put out a little pile of food on the counter, and the bird would fly down, grab the food, and go away. Then we realized the bird liked tofu. So we made sure whenever we had tofu, you know, we put tofu in the pile, and the bird would come down, grab the tofu, and fly away. And then come back again, grab the food, and fly away. So one day, the bird did that, and then came back a third time and sang the most beautiful song. Just went on and on with this beautiful song. It was like expressing appreciation. Didn't have to come back and sing to us. You know, I mean, there wasn't any food. Didn't want food. Just on its own accord came back and sat where it usually did on top of the water faucet and sang this beautiful song of appreciation. At least how it registered to me. And so it just... whenever I think of appreciation, I think of that bird, you know. And it struck me that appreciation is such a beautiful expression of culture. And it's also important. It's an important balance in life, because life has its ups and downs. And when we're up, we're fine. But when we're down, we're not. And when we're down, we can get discouraged and depressed and wonder how other people feel about us and, you know, go through moods and emotions. And one of the factors which helps us pull out of that is if we have been appreciated. You know, if we feel others appreciate us, it's easier to pull ourselves out of those moods. But if we don't feel appreciated, if we kind of feel isolated by ourselves, then it can be hard to pull out of such a state of mind. So appreciation helps everyone keep up, keep buoyant, and handle the difficulties in life a little easier. Appreciation also relates to the idea of training someone or correcting someone. We're all in situations where that manifests. Most common situation, of course, is parents and children. parents are responsible for training the children. But in the workplace, we may be a supervisor, we may have certain responsibilities for others under us, and then we're in the same situation of training others. Of course, a teacher in a classroom is in a situation similar to a parent. There's obviously training going on. We're molding the minds of a younger generation. In the monastery, we have structures, kulam structures, whereby the head of the kulam is responsible for training the individuals in the kulam. And sometimes we even have subgroups in the kulam, where there's an individual who's the most experienced responsible for training others. So this idea of appreciation carries over into all training situations, parent-child, teacher-student, supervisor, supervised, Dalivar, member of the kulam, applies to a guru, applies to any teacher, like a music teacher, a dance teacher, that we need to balance praise and blame. We have to balance praise and blame. What does that mean? It means we need to verbalize the good qualities, the successes toward our children. Praise them when things go well. Tell them how wonderful they are. Tell them we love them. We need to praise our students. For a supervisor, we need to praise those who are supervised when they do things well and encourage them. Show them we care. Dalivar praises a member of the kulams when they do things well. And then because the majority of impressions that have gone into the mind are one of praise, one that everything is going well, one that we're loved, when there's a need to correct, and that's verbalized, it's taken well. Because the majority of impressions that we have between the two parties is one of praise, one of love, one of kindness. So a impression of correction for doing something wrong isn't a devastation, because that's not the majority of impressions. But if we don't hit the right balance, you can see what happens. The mind gets filled up with too much correction, and then it doesn't find the right balance. Correction goes in upon other correction and doesn't produce the desired result. The behavior doesn't change. It's just one more correction going in among too many corrections. So the idea of a correction isn't to tell someone they're bad or wrong. The idea is to change behavior, right? We want to change someone's behavior. Their behavior isn't right for some reason. It can be improved upon. So in order to motivate the person through correction, it has to go into a mind that's filled with praise. Even a teacher, like a dance teacher. If a dance teacher only gives correction, eventually the student will give up. You know, say, this is impossible. I can't seem to do anything right. It has to find the right balance so that there's enough praise so that the correction is taken in a way that the person is motivated to change behavior. Otherwise, the person just gets discouraged and doesn't even try and change the behavior. Once, a long time ago, the idea that drove me from one part of California to the other, we had a retreat center in Northern California, and so peaceful, you know, just out in nature, quiet and beautiful. And you just go there and you feel happy and peaceful. So that's where I was, feeling happy and peaceful in this beautiful retreat center. And then Gurudeva drove me down to our center in San Francisco. And there were some personal problems among some people that were being discussed in a rather open way, and it was a bit upsetting to go from this beautiful, peaceful place into this situation where you're involved in sorting out personal problems. And of course, my first response was, well, gee, let's get back to this peaceful place, you know. Let's drive back to Northern California. And of course, I just thought it, you know, I didn't say anything. And Gurudeva said, well, peaceful places are nice, but you know, it's you have to learn how to handle problems and be able to find peace in a situation that has problems in it. It's easy to find peace when there aren't any problems anywhere, when you're out in nature in a beautiful place. But you have to learn to control the mind and control the emotions so that when you're in a situation which does have problems, you can still be peaceful. So I never forgot that. You know, that was a very interesting lesson. And helped give me a new perspective on problems. So our normal perspective is that we want to live and not encounter any problems, right? I mean, that's the goal. Let's just go along. Everything will be totally smooth, problem-free. That's bliss. That's what we're trying for. Well, believe it or not, we don't necessarily make spiritual progress in that situation because we're not changing our behavior. We're not seeing the areas in which we can improve ourselves. We're just going along, remaining the same. So it seems great. It's problem-free, but we're not trying to just remain the same, right? All of us are here because we want to change. We want to improve ourselves, unfold more spiritually. So to change, to unfold more spiritually, part of the process involves problems or improving our behavior. Gurudeva defined problems for me once. He says, problems are not problems. They are a repetition of the past that needs to be adjusted. Read that one again. Problems are not problems. They are a repetition of the past that needs to be adjusted. So what does that mean? It means we're creatures of habit. Both subconsciously, meaning we have certain habits like driving a car, you know, we do things the same. It's the nature of the mind to learn how to do something and then repeat it. We're creatures of habit. Plus, it's the nature of karma. We recreate similar situations for ourselves. We keep recreating a similar situation. We create it when we're young. We create it middle age. We create it when we're old. We keep facing the same situations, getting ourselves into the same difficulties. Why is that? Because we haven't figured out the lesson from the behavior. We haven't seen how we can change the behavior. For example, some men, when they face problems in the office, how do they solve the problems? By drinking more alcohol, a common solution. You know, that seems to solve the problem because you forget about the problem. Forgetting about a problem isn't really solving it. So it's a common behavior pattern. You face a problem in the office, therefore you drink a little too much, and that's your way of solving the problem. So that behavior continues until you change it. So sometimes it requires someone else to help you change it. You don't really see it objectively enough. That's the advantage of a guru. He can help you see, you know, he can help you hold the mirror up to your own behavior at a time you don't want to hold it up. You don't want to recognize this problem because you lose face. You lose some ego sense to admit that you're not as perfect as you thought you were. So, but seeing the problem, admitting the problem, and changing the behavior is the goal. So if we change the behavior, then we won't be repeating the past. We won't be repeating the past. So problems are good. Children misbehave. It's natural. It's good. It's not a problem in the sense of something that shouldn't happen. It's an opportunity for them to change their behavior with help. It's an opportunity to stop repeating the past. So it's a different look at problems. Huh? that we're not trying to avoid problems. We're also not trying to create unnecessary problems. But if a problem happens naturally, and we're involved in it, it's wonderful. Because it gives us an opportunity to hold up a mirror to ourselves, to our behavior, or ask someone else for help, to see our behavior and see what it is that we're repeating that needs to be adjusted. Problems are not problems. They are a repetition of the past that needs to be adjusted. Another aspect of problems is to accept the morning. These are our silpis, seven stone carvers assembling our Yerevan temple. Whatever happens when a problem comes up, whatever happens is in our karma. Nothing can happen to us. It's not in our karma. There's an interesting incident when the plane hit the Pentagon. They miscounted the number of people dead because one of the people that is normally in the office was in the plane and hit the Pentagon. So they counted him twice. You know, he even though he wasn't in the office, he still died as if he was in the office. I mean, it was a very interesting reflection, you know. He ended up in that incident even though he was flying somewhere else on that day. He couldn't avoid it. Whereas we know someone else, Mr. Patel, who worked in the World Trade Center, whose office was hit by the plane, who normally would be there, who came here on pilgrimage. Some of his friends talked him into coming here on pilgrimage. So instead of sitting in the office, which got hit by the plane, he was here. Very interesting. So whatever happens has to be in our karma. We can't experience anything that's not in our karma. So accepting what comes to us as our karma, you know, it's philosophically easy to do right now. Like say, oh sure, I believe that. That's karma. That's what karma means. But when it actually happens to us, when we get in the middle of some miserable problem that we're just really suffering from and wish had never happened, and how in the world did everything go wrong, and who can I blame, and you know, it doesn't emotionally necessarily register that we can blame ourselves. We really can never blame someone else, because whatever happens to us is in our karma, came to us. Handling these types of situations, it's helpful to have an inner perspective on who we are. If we only have an outer perspective on who we are, if we think we're this ego, I am this person, I'm a little better than this person, but not quite as smart as that person, and I earn more money than that person, and I'm a better social class than that person, and this, you know, if we're looking at ourselves in a totally external way, then when problems come up, it takes away from who we are, makes us less of a person. So we tend to try and hide the problem, ignore the problem, not deal with the problem, not learn from the problem, not change our behavior because of the problem, not accept that it's our karma. Why? Because we're busy holding our ego together, looking good for someone else. So obviously, we're not going to benefit from it. We're putting all our energy into some other way of reacting to it. So if we have an inner perspective on who we are, we don't do that. Gurudeva gives us beautiful inner perspectives in merging with Shiva on who we are. The first one being, we are the soul. We are a pure and perfect soul. We're just as good as anyone else because there's really only one soul. It's like water. You know, is this water better than that water? No, it's water. take air out of the room, put air in this jar, air in that jar. Is this air better than that air? No, it's just air, right? So is one soul better than another soul? No, it's like grab a little soul here, put it in this person, put it in that person. Is one better than the other? No, it's all soul. Just like air is all air. It's not better, it's just individuated in one place and individuated in another place. But it's really the same. So if we can really look at ourselves as a spiritual being, because we've cleared the subconscious of impressions of not being a spiritual being through all the tools that Gurudeva has given us. A lot of the tools in merging with Shiva are for the purpose of straightening out the subconscious. Erroneous thoughts went in the subconscious, problems went in that weren't resolved at the time, hard feelings went in that haven't been worked out. All of that gets packed away through years and years of living, and eventually can make us feel we're not the soul. The children start out okay. You know, they're happy. Tell them they're a spiritual being. They say, well, okay, sounds good to me. I must be. They don't have any impressions in the mind that make them think otherwise. So Gurudeva gives us all these wonderful tools in merging with Shiva to fix the subconscious mind if we use them. And using them just once isn't enough. Doing the Mahavasanadha Tantra when you're age 40 and not doing it again isn't enough. We need to do it every year because events come up every year, experiences come up every year, emotions come up every year, and go into the subconscious mind. It's like cleaning the house. You know, you can't clean the house once every 40 years. You know? No. Dirt comes in every day, right? You got to clean it regularly. So the subconscious mind is the same way. You know, you just have to maintain it, do your maintenance. We call that ashram sadhana here. It's a sadhana to keep the physical place clean. And likewise, the tools emerging with Shiva are a sadhana to keep the subconscious mind clean. Deeper perspectives are also given in merging with Shiva as to who am I. And the ultimate perspective, of course, is being the transcendent aspect of God, or Parashiva, the self, the absolute. And the advantage of that perspective is shown in Gurudeva's statement as to how you look at everything that's not the self. It says the mind is form, ever creating form, preserving form, destroying form. That is the mind, the illusion, the great unreality, right? From the self-God. So if you're actually holding that perspective because of having realized the self, then you not only are able to accept everything that comes to you as karma, but you're detached enough from the world to realize that whatever happens in the world is a result of what is set in motion in the past. The present is what was set in motion in the past. It's likewise, the future is influenced by what is set in motion in the present. It just keeps going along that way, going and going and going, kind of like an old car, bouncing along on a road with pukas in it. You know, it's just kind of a bouncy road going along, ups and downs. And it's just what it is, you know, joys and sorrow and this and that. And you can't fix it. You know, you just have to kind of detach yourself from it. Because if you're totally attached to it, it's very frustrating. Stock market goes up today and it crashes next month. We get a big bonus this month and next year we lose our job. You know, up and down, up and down. Like a car. There's a song that I'm thinking of, Larry Rivera's song. It's called The Puka Puka Road. You get this feeling, you're driving along and bounce, 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 you know. county wasn't fixing the roads, so he wrote a song about it, trying to motivate them to fix the roads because it was so bouncy. So that can be life. If you're totally attached to it, if you're clinging to it, it has that feeling of up and down, joy and sorrow. Boy, what a ride. But the more you can detach yourself from it, then the more stable you are. You don't want to detach yourself too much, end up in the monastery. Just enough. So you're not clinging to it. It's not your total source of joy. And happiness is what happens in the external world, because some days everything goes wrong. And you just can't prevent it. Why? Because of events done in the past or influencing the present. So the perspective of Parashiva, the self, particularly for the monks, is an excellent perspective to hold. That we are that which transcends the whole mechanism. Mechanism being anava, karma, and maya. An individual acting in form, experiencing the reactions to his or her actions. Anava, karma, and maya. That's all it is. It's a wonderful statement in Living with Shiva. Gurudeva's latest book, and first one in Four Color, about monastic life. And it's very interesting that Gurudeva chose to put it here because it comes from a writing called the Saivite Shastras, which normally we don't put in our public books. It's something we read. We don't even print it. We just read it to visitors to the monastery, Saivite Shastras usually. But he felt this was so central, he put it in the book so everyone would read it. So it explains the monastery in terms of its connection to the inner worlds in our tradition. It answers the question, what hooks the monastery up to the inner worlds? It also answers the question, what would cause the monastery to lose its hookup to the inner worlds? Very important question. So it's answered here. A legacy of devas from the entire parampara accompanies our monastic order, providing silent, unseen inner guidance and protection for old and young alike. As long as at least one person within the entire group of Madhavasis is going into and coming out of Parashiva once a day, the doorway to the third world remains open to the hereditary entourage of devanic forces that has been building up for over 2,000 years. This is because the Brahmarandra, the door of Brahman at the top of the head, remains open when Parashiva is daily experienced within a Matavasi community. It could be within the oldest monk or within the youngest. This great realization occurring time and time again within someone day after day keeps the door of Brahman open for the entire prana chakravala of monastics, keeping vibrantly strong the inner actinic connection with all gurus of our parampara, as well as with other sadhus, rishis, and saints who have reached these same attainments, and with the sapta rishis themselves who guide our order from deep within the inner lokas. Isn't that beautiful? I mean, that just states it so clearly. It's wonderful having it in the book so everyone will remember it and read it and understand how it works. So I was thinking, so the door of Brahman open is like, you know, a hole in the head being open to the inner world. So it's a new definition for a holy man. holy man is one who goes through the hole in the top of the head, right? Holy man. Go.